This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
It's Friday afternoon. The lights are on. Mark, thanks very much indeed for the coffee.
You bought it.
The top 10 coming up in just a moment. We also have some key reviews of these movies.
We're going to do The Wrestler. We're going to do Stuck, which I promised to do last week. It was the film of the week, and then we didn't get any time to do it. And I got a few emails saying, for heaven's sake...
You can't make a movie of the week something that you haven't reviewed.
No, it's fine. So I'm going to do Stuck. £7, the new film by Will Smith, and My Bloody Valentine 3D.
Okay,
and if we're lucky, Beverly Hills Chihuahua.
All right, and we're going to do... as I mentioned, expecting to go live to New York. Mayor Bloomberg there talking about the rescue of that plane in a few moments. Looking at the top 10, I'm just going to mention this email now, because... The Tale of Despero isn't in there. Anyway, this from...
Is that a problem?
Well, I just thought it might be in the top 10. That's all.
Okay.
It's not a problem. It's just people didn't go and see it.
No.
You sound surprised.
No, it's just it's fine.
Ricky in Edinburgh, BSc Honours, MPhil, PhD, etc. Dear Che Part 1 and Che Part 2, I attempted to take my two daughters, 7 and 4, to see the Tale of Despero at my local multiplex last weekend. There was only one showing early in the day, and it sold out while we were in the queue. In the screen next door, there was Madagascar 2, with 4 showings at various times of the day, playing to below half-empty audiences. Why do cinemas do this? I'll attempt to make it to the even earlier only showing of the same film this weekend before it drops out of cinemas for good, but... Ever since they saw the trailer for it on the High School Musical 2 DVD, the one film my girls have been looking forward to is Beverly Hills Chihuahua. Irrespective of how you review it, I know I will be forced into going to see it, but please help me prepare for the ordeal in advance.
Do you want me to...
Hang on. How bad is it? No, do you want to... Just a little tease, because that's coming up.
I mean, I can't know how I can do it. It's
in
not...
Just two words.
Not that.
No, that's it. Not that. Okay, so let's do the top 10 and see where we go. And at 10 is The Reader.
Which, is multiply nominated for awards. I have to say, I think is rather overrated. I think that the performances are good. And as you know, as a result of what happened at the BAFTAs, is that Kate Winslet is now nominated against herself in the same categories. At the Golden Globes, she won for Best Supporting Actress and Best Actress. At the BAFTAs, she's nominated for both movies, for The Reader and Revolution Road, for Best Actress, right? Which means, did you see the Golden Globe acceptance speech?
She
said, oh, and who's the other one, right? Well, it means if she wins at the BAFTAs, she'll stumble up to the stage, she'll have to apologise to the people that she's beaten, including herself, and if we're really lucky, she'll forget her name. Or, if we're really lucky, Angelina Jolie will win, because Angelina Jolie was the person whose name she forgot in the acceptance speech.
Do you think it is a little bit stupid that in The Reader she's Best Supporting Actress, where there is effectively no other actress in the film?
No, it's completely political. In the BAFTAs, they don't do that. The BAFTAs are better. I'm a BAFTA member, obviously, so I think that, but the BAFTAs, no, she's a leading actress, that's fine, so she's competing against herself.
Number 9 is Twilight,
which I liked,
I liked just as much.
Good, so
in fact, probably more.
No, I think we both liked it quite a lot. I think neither of us probably liked it as much as your
15-year-old
guest, right?
Madagascar, Escape to Africa is number 8.
Well, we're just mentioning it in relation to it being on many screens and Tale of Despero not. I mean, because Tale of Despero is essentially, British production, and it's animation, and it is a shame that if you want to go and see it and you couldn't get to go and see it and you had to settle for Madagascar 2, that is a shame.
We have Australia at 7.
Well, all of it.
Bedtime Stories at 6.
It's nothing like as good as Inkheart, which I notice has now dropped out of the top 10, which is a shame. I would like to see that sticking around for longer, although Bedtime Stories seems to be plummeting pretty fast.
Jimmy in Wakefield says, Dear Mitchell and Webb, dearest big sister sent us cinema vouchers for Christmas all the way from Australia. The 7-year-old cherub wanted to see Bedtime Stories, but after listening to your show last week, I put my foot down and we all went to see Inkheart instead.
Well done.
I must thank the good doctor for this decision. It's been years since I've been to see a PG film and I right enjoyed it, to quote Jimmy.
Great.
In fact, since then, I've been trying to find another 7-year-old to take it. It was that good.
You can go without a child.
Yes. You don't have to find a 7-year-old, Jimmy. Just go and see it. Not embarrassing.
There was one... What was it? There was one movie about which the thing that everyone said is that, parents shouldn't be... No over 14 should be allowed in without a child. If anybody can remember what it is, there was a particular film in which that worked. That was the case, but not in the case of Inkheart.
Anyway, we have Yes Man at 5.
No Man. Doing that joke again.
We'll return to that. Defiance is at 4.
I mean, well-meaning and solidly built. Interesting because the story is about, Jewish resistance fighters during World War II, so it's a story that isn't clearly isn't widely enough known. I mean, I didn't know about it. It is a very sort of nuts and bolts production, but it's a solid nuts and bolts production.
Bob Wallace from Sandy in Bedfordshire, number three. I mean, overwhelmingly, people want to talk about Slumdog. Just hundreds of emails that. But he also adds on about Defiance. He said, although sometimes it's ponderous, it does at least give Daniel Craig another opportunity to show his range. I did get a little fed up with all of the biblical references. Cain and Abel, Israelites in the wilderness, Moses questioning of his faith and leadership in the crossing of the marsh, being a metaphor for the flight from Egypt. I, along with Mark, though, did find the factual side of the film a revelation, as I knew nothing of this story.
Good.
And the numbers saved was amazing.
It is. I mean, that's it. You just think, why didn't I know this? And if it's funny enough, we were talking earlier on to Gus Van Sant. I mean, there was the suggestion that he was raising that actually many people don't know the story of Harvey Milk, you know, which seems amazing because it's such recent history.
Bride Wars at number three.
I mean, what is there to say other than it's ghastly and awful in ways you can't imagine, and Kate Hudson is just beyond terrible.
Slumdog Millionaires at number two. Now, just a random sample.
And you said there's been loads of them.
Absolutely. I mean, we just can't do justice to the huge debates going on here. Okay. Simon in Paisley, dear Kate and Kate, who starts off, you know, that where we talked about Shawshank Redemption.
Yes.
So there's a lot of Shawshank before you get to the Redemption. He says there's an awful lot of Slumdog before you get to the
Millionaires.
But Simon says, in all seriousness, Slumdog is a wondrously rich and deeply affecting movie-going experience in a way that The Reader, despite its clear pretension, simply isn't.
Yeah, I agree.
On which the scene where Jamal is under threat of having his eyes removed was as deeply disturbing as I've ever felt in a cinema. But that may be a spoiler, which is Kermode and Boyle's job. Ben from Watford, Most Improved Gymnast, 1985. Dear Mick and Keith, like most discerning movie fans, I'm looking forward to watching Slumdog, but not just because of all the awards. About 4 years ago, on the books panel on Five Live, Simon and his guests reviewed Vikas Swarup's book Q&A and all gave it a glowing recommendation, so much so that I promptly set about finding a copy to take away on holiday that year, only to discover that my father, also a regular podcaster and Wittertainment fan, had also been listening and done exactly the same thing. There's lots more stuff there from Ben. This has allowed me to bore my wife and friends by bleating on about comparisons to the source material in a smug but highly annoying manner. Keep up the good work.
The author, of course, was quoted in the paper today as saying, I don't know whether orphans do actually have their eyes in them, but hey, it was a good story.
Mark Barry, BSc Ons, PDG and so on. Dear Spike and Quiff, not only should Slumdog Millionaire win as the best film of the year, it's probably the best film for many a year. That'd be a good category, wouldn't it? Best film since, do you know what?
I can't remember when.
Indeed, if Slumdog is not in the top 10 films of the millennium so far, then I will stop listening to you two and go and do something more interesting instead, which is a 70s TV reference. Yeah. Wilbury Steve in Hove, I seem to be alone in thinking Slumdog was overlong and overbaked. Worse still, when the imminent Frost Nixon is taken into account, we appear to be witnessing a disturbing new trend. Entire movies based on 30 minutes of primetime television. Given the good doctor's antipathy to the box, does he not disapprove?
Well, the Frost Nixon interview wasn't 30 minutes of primetime television, it was longer than that, and I don't agree for one moment that that's what's happening in Slumdog Millionaire, because you're not alone. It did get some negative reviews. I mean, I know you always accuse me of only reading The Guardian, but Pete Bradshaw did give it a thumbs down in The Guardian. I mean, a waving thumb at very best, saying that it was overpraised.
Martin Lever says in his house they call it Slumdog Squarepants, which I like quite a lot. Ron in Newbury, who signs it Ron McPhee, age 51. I've been waiting since last Monday to send this email. Monday evening is normally pretty boring, so I took myself to the cinema and I had a burger just to support my credentials. It was a good quality one containing pineapple, egg, beetroot and the other more normal bits. Now hold in your collective minds that I walk out of many films partway through because I'm bored or annoyed by some other member of the audience. But not last Monday. I went to see Slumdog Millionaire, which is still at number two, which is why we've stuck there at the moment, without knowing anything about it other than it was set in India and is a British film. Virtually from the first image, I was captivated. Visually and culturally, it's fascinating, but then the acting of the different age groups, the story and the sounds were simply amazing. I have not enjoyed myself at the cinema so much since Lost in Translation, another fine film on a low budget. I will be seeing it again. I have concluded from all this that big money equals a good burger, but not necessarily a good film. Regards to both.
And on the subject of the acting, of course, one of the interesting things with the BAFTA nominations is that Dev Patel has been nominated for Best Actor, and he's up there with your Mickey Rourke's and your I think Dev Patel was probably quite surprised too,
all of which leads us to the number one movie, which is Role Models, which we'll be discussing.
You know,
that's outselling Slumdog.
Yeah, well, apparently that's because it's absolutely packed with big belly laughs and it is genius.
Good old Jimmy King. He knows.
Jimmy the Boy King. We must get him in here and remonstrate with him.
So, and just one other issue on Slumdog from Al Gale, who is wondering whether the certificate is correct, because it's 15. Got a it's a 15. He says, in comparison with the torture scene in Casino Royale, which is now my standard for judging 12 A-rated films, the 15 certificate seems pretty harsh. And although I'm all for keeping anyone under the age of 30 out of any screening where I'm present, yeah, it seems unfair on the makers of the film to limit the audience.
Well, as you know, the Casino Royale 12 certificate thing was a bit of a bone of contention for the BBFC, and there was an awful lot of griping about the fact that it should have been a 15. I think the same was actually true of Dark Knight, because Dark Knight's a fairly rough film as well. I think 15 is right for Slumdog. The question of whether 12 is right for Casino Royale and Dark Knight is a debate that will run and run. I don't think I don't think Casino Royale had the wince factor that I think had Slumdog did. But I do think that it's very important to restate that Danny Boyle was uncomfortable with that feel-good film of the decade advertising campaign, which is even now on a bus going past the side of your house, because it isn't that film. I mean, it really isn't that film.
It's not a feel-good movie, even though you feel better having seen it.
Yeah, you feel good afterwards, but then, you know, I felt good after seeing, well, you know, many really... Zombie Flesh Eaters, for example.
One of the movies out last week...
It was out on Friday, so it's out now.
Right, it was stuck, and you ridiculously suggested it was Movie of the Week, even though you hadn't reviewed it.
Yeah, no,
pointless.
I said it was a very good film. So it's done by Stuart Gordon, who is best known as kind of horror guy. He did Reanimator and From Beyond and Dolls and Robot Jocks and sort of exploitation movies. And most recently, he did a film version of Edmund, the David Mamet play, because he had done... I think he did the world premiere of Sexual Perversity in Chicago. And I didn't like Edmund at all. I mean, the direction was good, but I think the play is completely nonsensical. And it's just one of those kind of David Mamet light things. Well, now he's back in good old exploitation territory. Now, when exploitation movies were at their height, they were based on stories ripped from today's headlines. That was kind of how Roger Corman sort of summed up what an exploitation movie was. You take a situation and you exploit it. So the story is, Stephen Ray, our very own Stephen Ray, is a hung dog, dejected kind of guy. What other performance does Stephen Ray do? And he's walking along the streets, and he's run down by Mina Suvari, I can never do that, by Mina Suvari, who is a care worker who is in a state of refreshment. And she runs him down, and he gets stuck through her windscreen, right? She then drives home with him stuck out of her windscreen, parks the car in the garage, and leaves him there to expire, which he promptly refuses to do. Now, amazingly enough, although it's not factual, the thing is based on a true story, which did indeed happen in 2003 in Texas, when somebody was struck, October the 26th, 2001, went through the windshield. The person who struck them did indeed drive them home, and they were later sent to prison for extreme wrongdoing. So it actually
is an official crime.
Extreme wrongdoing. It's best film since
you've
know well, and yes, and we find you extremely guilty indeed. And what's interesting about Stuck is... it's an 85-minute stripped-down exploitation movie. It costs less than 10 grand to make. I think it's taken something like 70,000 grand since then. So, you know, it's doing all right. It's actually sort of, you know, it's making its money. 70 grand. What am I? Yeah. No, that's right. Yes.
What are you talking about?
It's made more money than it cost to make.
Fine.
And it's 85 minutes long, and it's also takes place in a very small area, and it reminds me of what B-movies used to be like when they were any good at all. And the reason that I wanted to sort of wave the flag for a little bit was that it's darkly comic, and it's, you know, jet black sort of satire, and yet it's also quite morbid and, you know, pretty wince-inducing at places, because there is Stephen Ray stuck through the windscreen of a car for the whole running time of the car, the whole running time of the film. And a couple of people I know saw it, and they went, oh, it was really sick and twisted, and why would I want to watch that kind of film, which is exactly the sort of recommendation that I want. It's a little ensemble cast, all doing pretty good work. Stephen Ray plays the victim absolutely perfectly, and what Stuart Gordon does is, he goes, okay, this is what a B-movie should look like. And we live in a world now when Quentin Tarantino keeps reinventing the B-movie as Grindhouse, you know, and spending thousands and thousands and thousands, you know, making this stuff that doesn't look like a B-movie at all. It just looks like, you know, yeah, nonsense. And so this is a proper B-movie.
Yeah, nonsense.
Yeah, but that's it. It's like, you know, there is this idea that Quentin Tarantino somehow represents the great B-movie aesthetic, and he doesn't. This represents the great B-movie aesthetic. This is what it should look like. It's tight, it's compact, it's based on, it's inspired by a true story. It's grisly, it's nasty, it's dark, it's odd, it's strange. And you know what? It's really rather enjoyable, and you are in and out in less than 90 minutes. Now, in a world when Grindhouse goes on for however long it is, you know, well over 2 hours, and makes everybody's bottom feel sore because you've been in the cinema for such a long time, remember Stuart Gordon. He's the guy who was making B-movies, because that's what he made. Go see Stuck. It's really, I liked it very much.
Julia Webb, BSC. I was shocked as I stood watching and listening to Mr. Kermode live from the BAFTA HQ the other morning. Does this man of great learning not know how to pronounce the word British?
What did
I
say?
Three or four times he must have said British in a, like, embarrassed to be saying, like, adolescent sort of way. Grow up, Doc, and enunciate your T's. Yours disappointed. But
how do I say British? I can't, now that I'm thinking about it, I can't.
British.
Don't I say British?
Well, I ask Julia Webb.
British? I don't say British. Do I?
It's Julia's problem.
Well, Julia, I'm aware, and I don't think I do. I mean, I do drop my T's sometimes. I mean, I did grow up in Finchley. It's legitimate.
A rough upbringing.
That's right. But that's the best line from Narnia, isn't it? You know, we're not heroes, we're from Finchley. British.
Is it £7?
No, British. No, we can do that. British. Yeah, yeah. Well, we could do £7.
Because this is interesting from Marissa. Dear Doctor and Special K, having seen the trailer on television for the latest Will Smith movie, £7, on numerous occasions, I've been struck by a new publicity tactic employed by the studio. Basically, a statement appears on the screen which says, contains emotionally intense scenes. Now, I certainly know what I think about some film executive marketing guru telling me how I should react to a film, but I'm curious to find out the good doctor's, not the other doctor's, oh, thanks very much,
thank you,
opinion on this new form of hyperbole.
Can I do you?
Contains emotionally intense scenes, which is presumably, you could say, Mary Poppins has scenes which are emotionally intense.
Well, this leads me...
Are there any movies which don't have emotionally intense
scenes? There are plenty of them, and they're not interesting at all. This leads me perfectly into the £7 review, okay, because...
That's why I read it out.
I know, but no, but just what has been said there leads me perfectly in, because, right, Will Smith stars in £7. We know this because of the poster, which is a picture of Will Smith. That's it. And it says £7.
It's got other kind of seven things.
Yeah, enigmatically, it says seven strangers.
Seven dwarves.
Seven, that's right, yeah. Seven brides for seven brothers. So actually, it does what it should do.
Seven and the Ragged Tiger.
And then seven and the Ragged Tiger. So it's enigmatic, right? And the poster is that kind of... And now, when we turn up at the screening, I get given this, and I brought it in. So I'm not making this up. There we go, £7. This is the statement.
Like a press release,
isn't
it?
No, this isn't. Well, there's the press notes are here, right? But here is the piece of paper. And the piece of paper says this.
You're waving more stuff around just because we're being...
On behalf of Sony Pictures Releasing, we are delighted that you could attend this special preview of £7. Well, I'm delighted to have attended it. Given the nature of the story, we would respectfully request that journalists refrain from revealing too much of the plot and giving away the ending of the movie to allow audiences to discover this for themselves. Now, this is very exciting because I didn't know when I was going in there was going to be a sort of great mystery. Woo! It's exciting. Then I won't be able to tell anybody about it afterwards. That's great. I haven't had one of those since, you know, The Sixth Sense. You know, the thing about he turns out to be a woman.
Yeah.
You wasn't allowed to do that either. Okay, so you go in. So I'm not allowed to tell you anything about the film, but what do I can tell you? Will is a man, right? He's a bloke in the film. And at the beginning of the film, he starts by dialing 911 to report his own suicide.
No.
Already, I'm on the edge of my seat. There we go. I'm sitting on the edge of my seat like that, okay? Now,
you don't have to.
He starts having flashbacks, right? A number of things happen. He's rude to a blind man in a call centre selling meat. Why? Who knows? He harasses a woman in a hospital who's apparently got something funny about her heart. Why? Who not, can't figure it out. Can't figure it out. Don't know what's going on. He claims to be from the IRS. Is he? I don't know. He might be. Maybe not. He's got a thing about jellyfish. It's just getting weirder all the time. And then he has this enigmatic discussion on a golf course.
You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. You said you were going to call me on the 15th. Today is the 19th.
I know. Doctor didn't have the results, so I had no information to give you.
Still, you should call me.
Yeah,
right?
Yes, I know.
We're still friends, right?
Yeah. I'm just... I'm doing some soul searching, you know?
Don't do that. We have a plan.
I know.
Do what you promised me.
I will.
Stop soul searching. And somewhere else in the script, it says, in 7 days, God created the world, and in 7 seconds, I shattered mine. Now, we're meant to be sitting there going, oh, what's going on? What's the mystery? What's the, what possibly could
it's
be?
Not about numerology at the again, is it?
No, it's not. Actually, you're lucky about that because that was number 23, which, you know, Jim Carrey thought was clearly 3 times 7.
We're a few remakes away from that.
Yeah, no, we are. And that was a Joel Schumacher film. Joel Schumacher, the guy who gave us Batman and Robin, the campiest of all the Batman and Robin movies, the campiest of all the Batman movies. Anyway, so I'm sitting there going, what's going on? What's going on? I know what's going on. It's Will Smith teaming up with that guy who directed The Pursuit of Happiness, because actually what he's saying through all this is, give me an award. I want an award because I'm in a film, which is slightly mysterious, but it's about a guy doing things that are actually very good, but he's seeming to be maybe a bit nasty, but he's not nasty. And we know he's not nasty because he's Will Smith. And on the poster, he's got the big ears sticking out, but he's not being nasty. He's being Will Smith.
Which voice is this?
This is the voice of Pete talking in the cinema very quietly, because you're not quite sure what's going on. What's the person texting? What's going on? Why is he seeing the guy on the golf course? What's the thing with the jellyfish? Do you think it could possibly be that the ending is as blindingly obvious as everybody else in the cinema? I saw it with the...
Is the ending that you're not supposed to be talking about?
Now, hang on. I'm not going to talk about the ending, okay? All I can say is this. 15 minutes into the film, if they shut the power down and they lifted you out and said, fine, write what happens. Now, you probably wouldn't guess the thing about the jellyfish until the jellyfish is, you know, you wouldn't have said, I bet at some point somebody introduces a jellyfish. But the minute the jellyfish turns up, you know exactly why the jellyfish has turned up. You start.
Why has the jellyfish?
I can't tell you because I reveal
it at the end.
I can't tell you.
Tell me.
No,
happens?
All I. Stop it.
Mime it.
No. Okay, mime it?
No, don't.
Okay, I'll mime it because it'll be on the webcam. But I could so easily mime what happens at the end of the film.
No, please.
If you don't want to know, look away. No, fine. So, but it is one of those things in which the film is coming at you with this thing about don't possibly tell anyone what's going on. And I'm not kidding. Caught you in an area and you're going, yeah, I know what's going on. It's that. And it's the thing, and he did that, and now he's doing this in order to make, and he's going to do that.
It's that
and
you what go, thing?
And you go, it's, okay, for you.
Yes.
Jesus of Montreal.
Yes.
It's that, but not Jesus of Montreal.
Oh, right.
Okay, fine, stop. So, anyway, but it's one of those things in which you're literally just going, no, surely, if you've given me the piece of paper that says I mustn't breathe a word of this to anybody before I'm going, surely he's an alien, or, you know, it's a whole thing's a hallucination in the mind of a dying man who's in Vietnam, or it's an implanted memory, he's been to Mars and he doesn't remember it. Surely, it's something more substantial than, oh, it's that. It's that thing. Well, it's the thing, and all it is Will Smith.
What thing?
The thing.
It's what is the thing?
Here's the thing. Will Smith.
What Will thing? Smith. You can't say here's the thing. It's a John Carpenter film. That was the thing.
Yeah, that was
but
the
what
thing.
Else is the thing?
Will Smith is doing exactly. You have to see.
Give me a clue about the thing.
Okay, I'll give you the clue but about the thing. Okay. You know what? He's a good man, and he doesn't really work for the IRS. He's working to make the world a better place in ways which are so deeply rooted in his own personal trauma, loss, and indeed guilt, that one could not even guess at the level of sacrifice which he is willing to go through in order to make right what is wrong. And you're going, oh, come on. You know, for heaven's sake, Hancock, fine, okay? Half of a good movie, running around, absolutely fine. Pursuit of Happiness, never understood the thing about that film at all. And people were sitting in the cinema. And I'm
there's
sure
a lot of
that
pursuit
everybody.
Before you get to the happiness.
And of course, the happiness is spelt wrong, but it's one of those quirky titles that's deliberately spelt wrong. Believe me, it's a dumb, self indulgent movie that reveals itself so early on that you sit there for the rest of the film going, yeah, 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 yeah,
get
yeah.
To the thing.
Get to the thing, and the Pope turns up and says, who cut your hair? It's like that gag, but you know the punchline.
Annoyed of Edinburgh.
And
says,
it's rubbish.
Kermode hasn't even finished talking about this film yet, but if he doesn't mention that Will Smith gives an incredible performance...
He doesn't!
He should go and stuff himself into the windscreen of someone's car and refuse to die. The character doesn't make sense until the end, and taking it apart doesn't do the film justice.
It doesn't make sense at all! It absolutely doesn't make sense at all. The only sense it makes is the blindingly obvious, oh, it's that story film.
Here's a text which is going to make you explode, probably. It's very good, though.
Is it from Sonny asking me to not give away the ending of the film? Have I been good?
Very good.
Have I given away any... Do you have any idea what
no,
the film
I have
is about?
No
Fine,
idea
good.
What's going on.
But go watch Jesus of Montreal first of all and then spoil it for yourself. What a great film. Sean says, Slumdog was good, but not that good. It was like a dull City of God. The disturbing scene wasn't nearly as dramatic as the foot shooting from City of God, nor was the colour or the vibrancy. Bit dull.
Well, I like City of God enough, you know. He's not Slumdog Millionaire, though.
85058, mail at bbc.co.uk. And The Wrestler, I would imagine, is where we get to next.
Yes, I was going to do The Wrestler next, but you said, should we do £7? And you read out that email, and it led me straight in, because it was exactly the thing about the only thing we can tell you about is it contains scenes of emotional intensity and jellyfish.
Devonshire Dave. Dear Professor Yaffle and Bagpuss, as an avid podcast listener, last week you asked for anyone who'd seen The Spirit to send in their thoughts. Rather than a review, I thought I'd send you this exchange of dialogue with the owner of the cinema when I arrived to see this movie.
Okay.
Owner. Spirit? Me. Yeah. Owner. Damn, I was going to shut the doors and turn it off. Oh, am I the only one? Yeah, it's poo. Needless to say, I should have heeded the warning signs. There you go. Owen Salisbury.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Dear Pounds and Ounces, about £7. Do you think cinema bosses run the risk of becoming metric martyrs if they show the film? Because it should be 3.175 kilos. But apparently now that's fine.
Is it?
You can call it whatever you want. This from Catherine.
When did that happen? Was there a ruling that I missed?
Yeah, the EU said it's fine, whatever you want to.
Okay.
If you want to do pounds, it's fine. Okay. I look for that's a sort of a summary of a very long.
They said it in Belgium as well.
I look forward to. There isn't a language, Belgian. There isn't a language.
French.
Thanks. Just checking. I look forward to downloading the podcast every Friday night and have annoyingly found myself in the car and the children have fallen asleep. Should I turn you off?
No.
Have twice the fun. Yeah. Len, dear Simon and Garfarkle, can you please explain your pronunciation of Chihuahua to my wife, who's just driven off to her tennis coaching in Harrogate?
Yeah.
Because
that's how
class kind of listener.
Yeah. Right.
She's never heard the story and doesn't get it. It dates from a former colleague of mine, Peter Powell, who was reading a dedication on Radio 1 saying, could you say hello to my wife, my children, da, 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 and also my pet dog, and it was a chihuahua, but he
read it out as Chihuahua.
And I just thought
it was funny. Since then, it's been impossible to ever say chihuahua.
And we'll get to the Chihuahua film a bit later on. Meantime, we have the return of Mickey Rourke, to everyone's surprise.
Mickey Rourke, an extraordinary life story. So he started out working with, he studied under Lee Strasberg. And then in his early, the Lee Strasberg Institute, I beg your pardon. And then in his early films, he did things like, Body Heat and Rumblefish and Angel Heart and Barfly. And he was really, really well considered. And he won an award in 1982, which is the Boston Society of Film Critics Best Supporting Actor for Diner. And I remember going to see him in the cinema. And I actually remember going to see Diner and coming out of it and really wanting to be his character in it. I thought it was incredibly cool. And he had that, you know, really sort of mumbly way of talking, which I really liked, and he looked a little bit like James Dean, and as I said, he looked a little bit like a young Brandon, and he was great. And up until Barfly, everything was really great, and then things just went terribly wrong. There was this collection of bad movies. There was A Prayer for the Dying, which is him going, you know, I want to be Irish, but I can't because I sound more Cornish.
Yeah. You don't want to listen to Mickey Rourke on Ireland.
No, believe me. No. Mickey Rourke's political understanding of the Irish conflict was, shall we say,
shallow.
Then there was Homeboy, which was him saying, I want to be a boxer. Then there was Johnny Handsome, which was him saying, I want plastic surgery, which was strangely prophetic. Then there was Wild Orchid, in which he demonstrated that he wanted Cary Otis, and that all ended up very badly. And then he did Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man, which is a film in which the product placement is so bad, it's actually in the title of the movie, which he had clearly done only for the money. And then everything started to fall apart. And there was a documentary in 1996, a television documentary called Mickey Rourke, Actor or Boxer? Because in 1991, he had gone back to take up professional boxing, deciding that actually he didn't want to be an actor anymore, that acting was for wusses, and what he really wanted to do was a boxer. And this thing about, is he an actor or a boxer, to which the answer was neither. And the year after that, he, in his lowest point, I think, made a film called 9.5 Weeks, The Return, another 9.5 Weeks, a.k.a. Love in Paris. So he'd made 9.5 Weeks, you know, the film in which he famously throws the contents of his fridge at Kim Basinger. Yep. Kim Basinger, who described him at one point as a human ashtray. I think she meant it in a good way, but somehow it didn't sound like that. So he ends
up... In what way could he interpret human ashtray in a positive way?
Well, she said it in the Kim Basinger way, didn't she? She was sort of saying it, because she didn't do harsh, and other than when there was that business when she lost the town because of dropping out of what was the film?
I've got no idea.
Boxing
what you're
Helena.
About
she was going to be in Boxing Helena, and then she pulled out of Boxing Helena. It was all a bit of a mess.
Anyway, wise move.
Things were not good, but she's not in another 9.5 weeks because she actually had a career and a life. And Mickey Rourke, everything had gone so badly wrong. They said, "Look, Mickey, we're going to make a straight to video sequel to 9.5 weeks, in which Kim's not coming back, but you can be in it." it. Would you like to do it? And he said yes. And it was directed by this woman called Anne Gorso. And I know this because Linda, my wife, wrote a book about straight-to-video erotic thrillers, amongst other things. And she interviewed Anne Gorso, who was the director of this film. And Anne Gorso said this brilliant thing in the interview, which was she said that they had got the... I mean, they had, this is a straight-to-video B-movie. This is how low he'd gone, right? And they got everything set up in Paris. And they were waiting for Mickey Rourke to come off and throw the contents of his fridge at Angie Everard, who was kind of standing in for Kim Basinger. I think she played Kim Basinger's sister. That's always how it works in these things. And she said, and you know, we were there in Paris, city of love. It was beautiful. We had the bed and the... And the honey and the petals and the Angie Everard, he was all very, she's French. He said he was so lovely and, you know, Montmartre. And then the plane come in and Mickey, he come off the plane. I see him coming through the... He look like Quasimodo. He said, we have to rearrange the whole schedule because he look like Quasimodo. And... Mickey Rourke had changed radically as a result of A, the boxing, B, you know, strange surgery as far as anyone can tell, and C, years of not being very good to himself. So things had and at that point, that was it. It was all over. Mickey Rourke was clearly unemployable. And then there was this very, very long comeback line. He was meant to have had a role in Thin Red Line, but he got cut out of it. Apparently walked off the set of Luck of the Draw in 1999 when they refused to let him get his pet Chihuahua in, because you know he's got this little dog.
He hasn't got one,
has he? He's got this really annoying little dog that he loves. It may not be a Chihuahua, it may be a toy.
By the way, is his comeback as long-winded as the preamble to the review of this film?
This is important because this is all part of the review, okay, fine? Okay. Then he was in Sin City, in which he played Marv, who was very sort of smashed up, and he appeared to be Marv without the aid of makeup. He was a kind of cartoon character without the aid of makeup. And he was going to be Stuntman Mike in Grindhouse. Now he comes back in The Wrestler, and in The Wrestler, he plays a guy who's been in the ring all his life, whose life is essentially falling apart, whose heart is failing on him, who has spent 20 years of his life having his face smashed into the canvas, and basically is a great, wounded, walking hunk of meat. And the reason that Mickey Rourke is right for the role is it's kind of like, that's the life that he appears to have led since he first burst onto our screens in Diner and Rumblefish. Here's a clip.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
That's okay. When was it?
A couple of weeks ago.
Oh, how are you feeling?
I don't feel like Hercules.
What happened?
I just was walking in the dressing room and the guys told me I just dropped like a brick and I don't remember nothing. Well, now the doctors tell me that I can't wrestle no more.
What are you gonna do?
You know, I just don't feel right. And that's why I wanted to talk to you. You know, because I don't want to be alone.
Randy. You should be with your family now. Don't you have a daughter? Where's your daughter?
My daughter, she don't like me very much.
I don't believe it. Everybody needs a father, and trust me, and this kind of thing brings people together.
Now, that's one of the quieter moments.
Not a lot of wrestling going on.
No, the louder moments consist of Mickey Rourke in the ring doing the wrestling with the, you know, in the very theatrical pantomime way of wrestling, in which they all agree beforehand who's going to do what, but it is to still get hurt, but obviously it's not a kind of real wrestling match. I mean, I think it's no surprise to anybody to know that some...
It's not a genuine sport.
Apparently
contest.
Some of them genuinely aren't. Some of them, when the people produce, you know, the barbed wire and the sticks and the chairs and the staple guns, for example, apparently it's not spontaneous, it is planned in advance.
I don't remember that on ITV on a Saturday afternoon.
The scenes in The Wrestler in which they do wrestle each other with staple guns do look surprisingly verite and done for real. Now, here's the things to say about the film. Firstly, it is the role for which Mickey Rourke has clearly lived all of his life to do this. I mean, he's incredibly bulked up. He was a boxer. He has genuinely been down and out. He has found his way back. He's now won a Golden Globe. He's just been nominated for the BAFTA. It's very unlikely he won't get nominated for the Oscar. And we now face a situation in which it is entirely possible that Mickey Rourke will get up on the Oscar stage and do what he did at the Golden Globe stage, which was thank his dogs for standing by him during the lean years. So Mickey Rourke's performance is terrific, but of course it's terrific because it's kind of him. The other two things to say about the film, and these are very important, these have been overlooked slightly. It's directed by Darren Aronofsky, who really had to kind of grapple his way back after The Fountainhead, which was a movie which was incredibly sort of ambitious and many timescales and strange and science fiction influence, and everybody hated it. And it was a total stinker. I liked it, actually, but it went down really badly. No, I mean, I don't think it was a stinker. People hated it, colon. They thought it was a total stinker.
You mean you...
No,
you,
I liked it.
You mean you were out of step with
I was out of step
else.
With popular opinion, funny, yes. But I thought that movie was really good. And the other thing is that Marisa Tomei's role in the film is every bit as important as Mickey Rourke's, and here's why. Because Marisa Tomei plays this pole dancing stripper who's his only friend. We heard him there in the clip. And actually, one of the central tenets of the film is that essentially him and Marisa Tomei are sort of the same thing. They are both people whose bodies are on display for entertainment and who are being terribly exploited by their audience on the one hand. But the difference is she seems to have some kind of handle on the way in which her job is going and the difference between the person that she is on stage and the person she is in real life, whereas he doesn't. He genuinely is Randy the Ram and he can't get away from it. And I think that people have slightly underestimated how much Marisa Tomei's performance actually mediates what might otherwise simply be Mickey Rourke walking around with this kind of very sort of strangely monstrous visage moaning about how bad life has been to him in between being slammed into the wrestling. The wrestling scenes are really tough. The wrestling scenes do look like people are genuinely getting hurt, and I believe that they probably were. I mean, I think it's quite hard to
genuinely
fake
using
stuff.
A staple gun.
No, well, no, I mean, it must be a special effect, but blimey, it looks like they're actually doing it. I mean, apparently this is not unheard of. People do staple each other in hideous ways in some of these extreme sports things, and it's all horrible. I mean, it's all absolutely grotesque, but there we go. It's a strange world. But the point that I want to make is you can't underestimate the importance of Darren Aronofsky's direction, or indeed the importance of the script, but you cannot underestimate how important Marisa Tomei's role is in making Mickey Rourke's character work. And this is, people keep saying to me, oh, well, it's a man's movie, right? It's a man's movie. It's about people fighting each other. It's not a man's movie. I think it's a movie for everybody. I think people can be, I mean, obviously grown-ups. Yeah. Kids, yeah. I mean, but the best
couldn't
line...
Couldn't get in to see Tale of Despero. Let's see the rest.
And the best line in it is, Marisa Tomei has it, when she says, you know, he's all battered and bruised and he's got these things and there's a kind of Christ-like thing going on with him. You know, he's often sort of seen laid out in a sort of messianic pose. And at one point, Marisa Tomei says to him, and he's got all these wounds, she says, you know, it's like the Passion. And he says, what you mean? She says, no, you know, the film, The Passion of the Christ. She says, you should see it. You'd love it. They just get this guy and they just beat him up for 2 hours. And that's almost the best critique I've heard of Mel Gibson's film in a very long time. I think the rest of it is a very fine piece of work. I think Mickey Rourke has every... Sorry.
Leave your High School Musical pen alone.
I was just getting excited and I accidentally prodded Zac Efron.
That's your dream again.
That is. And I've run out of steam now.
Okay, good. So here's Bobby in Birmingham, who says, "Dear George and Barack, going to see Slumdog. I was going to watch Slumdog this evening, and I intend to embark on an epic cinema marathon this weekend with my good friend Sophie in an attempt to see all the award season films at the cinema.
Okay,
it's annoying how they all come out at once, but I thought it's important to see them all at the cinema. One of those films will be The Wrestler.
Yeah,
and I'm very intrigued to hear what Mark has to say, because I have no interest at all
in wrestling.
WWF." All that. Yeah. It's nonsense, frankly. But does Dr. K think this might be a problem when watching the film?
No, I mean, I've got no interest in wrestling. I was once on Radio 5 with you to present the show on Radio 5 with Karen Keating, and we had some WWF wrestlers came on, and I suggested, I thought it was kind of, you know, obviously the whole thing's fit, and they got really cross. They got really cross about the idea that it was a theatre, you know, it was a theatrical performance as opposed to an actual fight. But no, I think it's interesting. I have no interest in wrestling whatsoever.
He also says, this is Bobby and Bowie, it might be she, actually, that you always say that Julian Sands has never been in a good film, but could I just point out he has been in The Killing Fields in 1984, which is an excellent film. Could this be the exception to the rule? We haven't talked about Julian for a while.
No. Well, I mean, he has been in good films. I mean, he's in Leaving Las Vegas. It's just the bit that he's in is rubbish.
Sarah, listening online in Brussels, could you congratulate Dr. Kermode on insulting half of Belgium by only naming French as the language used here?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Belgium is, of course, officially bilingual, the other half being Flemish or Dutch, depending on who you talk to and their agenda. Let's cause an international conflict. A couple of movies to get through before
okay,
we
so
finish.
That's very quickly, and can I just like to apologise to all of Belgium and say that I'm very much looking forward to seeing... JCVD this evening, which is the new Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, which is apparently a bit of a departure for Jean-Claude.
Meaning?
It's good.
Okay.
I hear. Anyway, so Beverly Hills Chihuahua, the voice of Drew Barrymore in the mouth of a dog whose mouth moves in the manner of Babe, you know,
yep.
With the use of
real
pigs. Okay, fine. You've seen the trailer. Okay,
I thought it looked quite...
Yeah, he did.
Entrancing, actually.
So she's a pampered pooch. She's owned by Jamie Lee Curtis. Jamie Lee Curtis has to go off on holiday, leaves the pampered pooch in the care of a young woman who the pampered pooch doesn't like. Young woman decides to go to Mexico. Ooh, things happen. Pampered pooch is off on her own and ends up visiting Mayan temples and finding the original Chihuahua race, who take over and teach her that, in fact, there is more to being a Chihuahua than being a handbag accessory. And along the way, with the Mayan temples, there is a whole subplot about dogfighting. So, in fact, if you think about it, on one level, it's basically Apocalypto meets, what's that other movie? Amores Perros, but for kids. Only, of course, it isn't, right?
And if you do go to the cinema, just see what happens if you say, could I have one adult and three kids, please, for Beverly Hills Chihuahua, and just see what happens.
Here's what you really need to know. This is the lovely extended classification information from the BBFC. Spoiler alert, information may include plot details. You contains very mild threat, but listen to this. Beverly Hills Chihuahua is a comedy about a spoilt little dog who gets lost in Mexico. Very mild threat. The threat occurs in a couple of scenes where the doggy heroine is placed in danger. The strongest scene is probably that in which she's in a dogfight arena with a Doberman. And I mean, it's a Chihuahua. Yay big, right? Doberman. But it says, but there's no baring of teeth or snarling, and the dog, and the big dog does little but sniff the Chihuahua. The humour in the little dog chatting incessantly during the encounter helps to remove any real tension.
Well, that's
so
all right,
bear
then.
In mind, there is absolutely nothing there. That said, I was going, I did laugh a few times. In the scene when they get to the Mayan temple and they meet the sort of the Chihuahua king who teaches them that you are not just a handbag accessory. What accent is that? I'm trying to
no
do Mexican.
Idea. Camp Mexican,
no,
I think.
We don't need no stinking badges. You are a Chihuahua and you have a great history of Chihuahua-ness. And they all learn
Portuguese?
They all learn to say, pardon me?
Portuguese?
No, but it's great. It's like a kind of I'm Spartacus thing. He says, we are not handbag accessories. They all go, no mas! We are not just funny little things with little jumpers. No mas! We are! And, it, and funnily enough, a little part of me went, I'm responding to this. I'm actually, it's
you
got,
cry,
it's got on.
You?
No, but I had, ooh, a, I just had close. A, li- I had a little moment. I had a little moment.
Quickly,
and
My
chuckle.
Bloody Valentine.
My Bloody Valentine
in 3D.
Okay, so all you need to know, we haven't got time for a clip, so let's not do one. It's a remake of the 1981 Canadian slasher movie, which was famously cut by the MPAA. Or, you know, the American censors. And so it was going to be very gory. And then apparently it had 9 minutes of gore taken out of it, which kind of defeats the object of a slasher movie. So now it's back again. It's in 3D. And the story, they do the first movie in about the first 10 minutes. They do it all again. But essentially, there's a mine. There's somebody down a mine. Mine collapses. One person blamed for it. He's down the mine. He's gone. But is he gone, right? Several years later.
Is he?
Well, no.
What is the thing?
Will Smith.
Has
I don't know.
Gone?
What's he doing? Who's the guy in the golf course? What's
Seven
with
the
squid?
Tiger.
What's the thing? Fine,
always
okay?
Poor.
Bunch of kids go. They say, I know we'll have a party in a mine because all that story about the bloke and the thing, he's gone. But he isn't gone, okay? So in the first 10 minutes.
Well, is he or isn't he?
Well, that's the
okay,
mystery.
That's it.
It's the mystery to be solved, right? Then that's out of the way in the first 10 minutes. Then the rest of the film is later, everyone comes back. He's gone. Is he gone? No, he's still running around. Now, all you need to know really is that in terms of 3D, pickaxe is weapon of choice, right? Because 3D is pointy. 3D is the pointy genre, the genre in which things come out of the screen at you
point.
Like this.
It
points. No, not pointing at pointing. But
we're
going
to talk about this with John Lasseter because he's on next week talking about the new.
Well, his argument is that, of course, it isn't about that. Actually, what 3D is about is the immersive experience, putting you inside it rather than things pointing out of it. In the case of My Bloody Valentine 3D, it's not really about immersing you in the mind. It's about things pointing out. It's about the spiky bit of the mind going k-dunk and coming out of the screen. Often through a bunch of soft tissue that it comes out of the screen at you. And on the good front, there's a lot of gore, there's a lot of offal, there's a lot of squidginess. There's absolutely crass sexist nudity. I mean, in the past it would be people running around in bikinis. Well, now it's the noughties, so people are running around as nature intended, or at least as slasher nature intended. And it is absolutely nuts and bolts. And it's probably not, I mean, in terms of horror 3D, nothing is going to come close to Flesh for Frankenstein, which is still
Andy Warhol.
The A plus Andy Warhol's one. Flesh for Frankenstein. But you know what? It does what it says on the packet, and it's a Friday night movie.
Movie of the week.
Well, shall we say £7?
No, let's
no,
say the
Wrestler. Stuck, because that was last week. No, let's do the Wrestler. No, it is. The Wrestler is really, really good and really worth seeing. And all that stuff about Mickey Rourke's career was important to understanding why the movie works.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.